Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Neil McCormick, the Daily Telegraph's chief pop and rock critic. He's an author, radio pundit, and television presenter. His best-selling memoir, Killing Bono, was turned into a feature film in 2011. Elton John said it was the best book I've ever read about trying to make it in the music business. His novel, Hashtag Zero, is a pitch-black satire about a pop star on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Also with us is Ayelet Gunder-Goshen, who's an award-winning novelist and clinical psychologist based in Israel. Both of her previous novels, Waking Lions and One Night Markovitch, are international bestsellers. Her latest novel, Liar, is a controversial tale of lies and their consequences. It's about a teenage girl who falsely accuses a male celebrity of sexual assault and is a gripping study of moral dilemmas and what we're willing to believe. And finally on tonight's book show is Catherine Wallace, an experienced blogger whose blog I Know I Need to Stop Talking has around 140,000 followers on Facebook. Her debut novel, Smashing It, is about Gemma, a single parent who's turning 40 and learns that being a good parent is just about being good enough. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Neil McCormick. He's the Daily Telegraph's chief pop and rock critic. He's an author, radio pundit and television presenter with his own music weekly interview show, Neil McCormick's Needle Time, which is broadcast on Vintage TV. His best-selling memoir, Killing Bono, was turned into a feature film in 2011. He's with us on the book show to talk about his novel. It's called Hashtag Zero. It's a pitch-black satire about a pop star on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Welcome to the book show, Neil.
Greetings from freezing UK.
Oh, I'm not going to say the same about here. It's pretty nice here, I have to admit.
Well, the sun is out, but it doesn't seem to be making much difference to the temperature in London.
Absolutely. So it's great to have you with us on the show. And before we talk about the new book, I have to ask you about your memoir, Killing Bono. If people haven't heard of it and haven't read the book or see the film, they'll think, what? What does he mean, Killing Bono?
Well, no Bonos were harmed in the production of that book or film. Yeah, I went to school with Bono. We were childhood friends, really. And we both got into rock and roll together. We had our heads turned in the bursting of punk rock upon the world, and we both had bands and set off on a path to conquer the world. And one of us did, and one of us unfortunately couldn't even conquer his own haircut. So I wrote a book really about my failure to make it in the music business, about the struggles, the ordinary struggles of people that people have in bands, young people. You know, I spent a long time. It was my dream. And, you know, while I wasn't really getting anywhere, I would be playing the Wembley Coach and Horses, and you know, you two were in Wembley Stadium. So I became a bit haunted by my friends' success. And at one point I said, you know, the problem with knowing you is you've lived my life. And he said, that's because I'm your doppelganger, Neil. And if you want your life back, you'll have to kill me. And so, I never killed him, but I got a good book out of it.
Oh, fabulous. And Elton John gave you a great quote as well for the book.
Yeah, well, Elton said, he called me up and said it was the best book he had ever read about trying to make it in the music business. And I said, that's very nice. Can I use that on the cover? The strange thing is I didn't even know Elton at that time. I have interviewed him since then, but I hadn't interviewed him at that point. And I've got to know him. He's a real music enthusiast. He got my number from somewhere and he just called up and went, Neil, it's Elton. And the funny thing is, you don't go, oh, come on, you're pulling my leg. Cause there's only one Elton. He sounds exactly like him. And so that was a lovely highlight of that whole time.
Fabulous. I wonder if he got your number from Bono.
Yeah, probably.
So tell me about your interview show that you do. You said you've interviewed Elton. Have you interviewed any other big music greats?
Well, I've interviewed all the music greats, I usually say, and then someone says, oh, what was this one like? And I went, I didn't interview them. Now, I've been writing about music and since I was a teenager, really. I sort of, at the same time as I had bands, I stumbled into a life on the fringes of the music. I went to art college and I became an art director very young of an Irish music paper called Hot Press. Started writing reviews for them. And then when I was about 30 and my music career was going down the bucket, I concentrated more on the writing and I've been doing that ever since. And I'm the Daily Telegraph's music critic. So I've been doing that for about 23 years. And I've had a show on Vintage TV called Needle Time interviewing people for a few years. And so, you know, I've spoken to nearly everybody. It would almost be easier to say who I haven't interviewed, which is basically, I think, Madonna. And, you know, there's a few people I missed along the way, but almost everyone.
Yeah.
Elton is a great interview, always, you know, he's just, because he's just passionate about music. He loves music, and that's always a pleasure to chat to somebody who does.
Yeah.
Leonard Cohen, I always say, was my greatest. I mean, I love Leonard Cohen. I loved him. And I spent some considerable time over the years for me. I interviewed him 3 or 4 times. And the first time, you know, I spent the whole day with him and he was just so gracious and so lovely to everybody and such a kind of font of wisdom and so funny as well. You know, it was like a cross between a biblical prophet and a stand-up comic in a really nice suit, you know.
Have you ever been really surprised by people who you've interviewed? So, you know, ideally, if you're maybe not a fan of them to begin with, you're not necessarily a lover of their music, but then you speak to them and think, wow, actually, they're a really nice guy. And then you kind of maybe start to get into their music a bit more because of how they came across when you spoke to them.
So I'd say that does happen. And it happens the other way as well.
Yeah.
Where you go in thinking, I really like their music. And you come out thinking, I'm never going to listen to that again. The reason I've been able to do this so long is I try to be very open-minded about music. I love music and I am appreciative of the people who make it. And I used to make it a lot myself. And I know that, you know, making art in general comes from a good place. It doesn't tend to come from a cynical place. And, you know, some of the nicest people are not the people whose records I would play in my house necessarily. But, you know, I try and understand what it is about that music that other people like so that you can write something that their own audience can appreciate. I'm not a cynical writer. There's a lot of that within music journalism. But someone like Rick Astley, you know, I wouldn't say my record shelves are bulging with with Rick Astley records, but what a lovely gentleman he is, you know.
Yeah.
And he's passionate about music and he's made a life in it, and you have to respect that.
I think that's the key, the idea of speaking to someone who's passionate about their subject, you know, be it music and their music style. If someone's talking passionately about something, it's infectious, isn't it? It makes you want to listen.
I always want to speak to people who are going to talk about their art, not about their marketing campaign or the bottom line, which can be slightly disappointing. And some Americans have a very business-like attitude towards music. John Bon Jovi, not that I would have listened to a lot of John Bon Jovi before. I have to say, I could never listen to him again after his, utterly business-like proposal about how he saw himself and what he was doing. I think, well, you know, you're just selling a product and you are the product, but you know, I don't want product. I want blood. I want heart. So
yeah, it must make a huge difference. So why did you decide to write this book then? It's different to other things that you've done, would you say?
Yes. Well, it's the first fiction, and that immediately puts you into a different place. You know, I've written memoirs, I've written nonfiction, and I write as a journalist all the time, and you're bound by the truth of that particular situation that you're trying to convey and what you can dig out of it. And I love it. You know, actually, you know, it's a really privileged platform to be in, to be on, to have a place where you can talk about things that you're interested in to an interested audience. And I have a constant sort of commentary. I feel like I'm in the conversation of what music means in Britain and in the world at the moment. So it's a great privilege. But fiction is something that blooms in your mind. You know, I've been a fiction reader since I was a small boy. You know, I was raised, I was a member of the Puffin Club. I've been reading novels since I was very young. I read a lot of novels now. And when I think about why I wrote it, you know, I might have said, well, I haven't done this before and I want to try and do it. But that isn't really the truth. The truth is it wrote it, you know, the story bloomed. It nagged, it grew in my head, and many, many stories have done that over the years, but I haven't written them down, or I haven't finished writing them down, because like most writers, I have, you know, drawers full of unfinished novels and scraps and notes. But so what's different this time is that the story possessed me enough to want to see it through to the end, to finish, to actually write the whole thing, and then to get it over the finishing line through a publisher, through an editor, and into the world. And it's really a story about the same kind of things that I'm interested in. I was writing about my memoir about what drives art, where does it come from? And the truth of that is deep inside us. It's a book about, in some levels, family. The wounds they create and where our need to express ourselves come from. So it's a young pop star in an environment I know very well. It was also a chance to write about that environment with no restrictions, you know, to go behind the red cordon and say there's a kind of madness in fame. There's a madness in that life of obsessive glare of fame that we have in the 21st century, and this is what's happening, and this is someone who's in that space, and you can just take it to extremes. You can say what you want, you can express it exactly how you feel. You're not treading on anybody's toes or you know, offending anybody, because they're not real people.
Yeah, it must be quite liberating.
It was very liberating. It was an immense pleasure to write. And ultimately, I guess that's what we're doing. You know, you're right. Most of the times you're writing you know, for an audience. I write for money. You're thinking about your audience. But this time I was writing for the pleasure of the story itself. And that was incredibly liberating. In fact, I had an experience that was almost spiritual, and it makes me very, I know the story is something that's utterly vital to me. I think it's something that's utterly vital to human beings. We tell the stories of our own lives. We make our life into a story. We myth make our own life, and myths and stories have fed into our lives constantly. And while I was writing this, I did that thing that writers do. I went on a retreat. I went to a cottage of isolated from phone signal. There was no phone. There was no internet. Just because I had to, you know, get busy, get some words on the page. And in that space, I did get into what's called the flow. You know, I got into that place where the words were just coming like a torrent. The characters were coming alive. The story was springing tributaries. And I felt completely like I was conducting this material that was springing from a well that had seemed to have no end of, you know, like a torrent. And I wrote 80,000 words in 2 weeks. And you can't, you know, create that situation every day and every moment of your life. We have lives. I have children. I have a wife. I have a job and responsibilities. And I appreciate all those parts of my life. But it was amazing to know that sort of river of creativity is accessible. You know, for those few weeks, it was a lovely thing to be swimming in it.
Yeah. Do you think you might do that again then when you write a book?
I have already done it again because the publishing world is so slow. You know, by the time you deliver your book, they're saying, oh, I remember sort of giving it to an editor and he said, you know, this will be out in spring. And I said, oh, spring, you know, next year. And he said, no, spring the year after. Oh, and you think, whoa. And so, you know, yes, I have been writing another book. The problem is you have to put these out into a marketplace and sell them and see how they do. And there's all that kind of constraints that are the slightly harder place of being a writer. I mean, it's a tough sell. You know, there are too many books. There are too many books. That's the truth. We're book lovers. And, you know, to me, going into a library or a big bookstore is like going into a cathedral. But I can become overwhelmed by the number of books on the shelves. And now, you know, here's another one. You know, why should anyone read it? You know, I hope that mine has a place on those shelves. But it's just a story that you, the writer, feel the need to tell. It's harder to justify why it exists in the world. I remember saying to Ian McCulloch, I used to go and see Echo and the Bunnymen a lot, and I was chatting with him one time, and he said, are you going to write a book? And I said, you know, there are too many books. And he said, that's a good title for a book. He said, I'm going to write that book. There are too many books, and all the pages will be blank. So maybe I'll write that one.
Yeah. Well, like, you could say the same thing about music, couldn't you? You could say there are too many songs.
There is, you know, there is too much of everything because everything is recorded now. But that we human beings are naturally creative. I don't think it's a special thing where there's artists on one side and the rest of the human race on the other. You know, children paint and draw and sing and write with such freedom. And sometimes, you know, the path that you take in life either lets that free or shuts it off. We are creative. We have got stories to tell. And this is my story. You know, this story, this book is about an obsession with fame, about pop stardom in the 21st century, right at this point we are now, where things are very different to fame 500 years ago, 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, probably even 20 years ago. You know, the world has changed. And so you're dealing with trying to make sense of the moment that you're in. And so there's new art all the time, because that is what the art is doing. It's the human being making sense of this moment in time.
And in terms of fame today, do you think it's exciting times or do you think it's a bit of a worry?
Oh, I think it's an absolutely terrible thing. And, you know, when I was a teenager, I wanted to be famous. I wanted to be a rock band, but fame was a different beast. And I'm kind of glad in some ways that it didn't visit itself upon me. Now it's a terrible space to be in. Everybody wants to be famous, but it's, hey, we're in that Andy Warhol fame, you know, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes moment, but it's, you're under attack from the moment you are. So your ego gets swollen, which has always been a part of fame, which is a dangerous part. But at the same time, we don't venerate famous people the way that we used to, you know. So you're under attack, people saying, you know, why should you exist? Why do you, you know, saying horrible things about you, swarming around you on social media. At the same time, on the other side, people boosting you. And it's just this weird, weird, dangerous, psychologically disturbing space. And every moment is visible to everyone all the time. Mm. You know, I've seen paparazzi stalking famous people. That is a weird thing to see. You know, it's like watching big game hunters, you know, in an urban setting, creeping down the pavements with their long lenses. Just the invasiveness. It's not a beautiful, well-balanced place for a psyche to be nurtured.
And with regards to the paparazzi and things, a lot of people in this modern day say, well, they're fair game. You know, they chose to be famous. They chose to put themselves in the public eye a lot of the time. Therefore, they're fair game. They've got to expect to be followed by photographers and have abuse on social media. And it's like, it's a weird concept.
There is a fair game. You start on a path. When you're young, you don't necessarily understand what that means. The loss of freedom that comes with fame, the loss of privacy is something I don't think that a younger person can really comprehend until it's happened to them.
Yeah.
You know, you go in, you're a young person, you want to be celebrated, you want to walk into a room and make a ripple. But when it gets to the point where you can no longer observe, every room you enter, you kind of disturbed by your presence, then you can start to lose a grip on reality, I think. And people, you know, do find themselves in very strange spaces. And, you know, we don't choose fame in the end. You know, there's certain professions as well where if you want to be a singer, if you want to be an actor, if you want to be writers, we don't have paparazzi stalking writers. So I think that's a fairly safe profession. But if you want to put yourself out into the world, it's not just about fame. It is about a projection of ego, but it's about, this is what I want to do. And for it to be heard, it has to be there in the world. It doesn't really mean that you're giving permission for everyone to take a piece of you.
No, I agree. Absolutely. It's a very interesting subject. And if people want to get a copy of your book, it's out now. It's called Zero. You say #Zero. Is that what you're calling it?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, I suppose you do say #Zero. Bono gave me the title for this, I have to say. So it was going to be called Motherless Child. And for some reason, the publishers started feeling that this was, they say it's a woman's title. And I'm saying, well, I don't see what that's got to do with anything. But they would say, oh, it's like a, you know, they have all their genres that they want to squeeze things into.
Yeah.
It is about a motherless child. It's about somebody with that gaping hole in their heart thrown into the world. But it's a big comic, satirical odyssey with a lot of energy. And they just felt it was a bit too touchy-feely. So I said, I hadn't have a title. And I was talking to Bono about it. And he said, what's the name of your character? And I said, Zero. And he said, well, there's your title right there. That's good, it's punchy, it's catchy, it's short, it look good on logos, you know, all that kind of stuff that he's learned from 40 years of selling U2. And so I thought, well, he knows what he's talking about. I put the hashtag in front of it to make it about this modern moment when you're no longer a person, you are a hashtag.
Yeah.
you know, you're just a brand. And I thought that was clever. I'm not sure it is, because of course you can't then put a hashtag zero on social media. It gets rather complicated.
Well, that's exactly, it's a fully formed hashtag, isn't it? People don't need to add anything to it at all.
Yes.
Fabulous. Well, it's out now, and it's by Neil McCormick, who we've been chatting to. People can buy the book on our website in the TRE bookshop section on tre.radio. Neil McCormick, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Israel is Ayelet Gunder Goshen, who's an award-winning novelist and a clinical psychologist. She's been with us on the book show before, and her previous novels, Waking Lions and One Night Markovitch, are both international bestsellers. She's with us back on the book show to talk about her latest novel, Liar. It's a controversial tale of lies and their consequences. Welcome to the book show, Ayelet.
Hello, good to be here.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us again. And an interesting topic for your latest book. Dare I ask where the inspiration came from?
Well, The Liar is actually based on a real story that happened in Israel. It was a very known case of a girl who accused a man, an Eritrean refugee, of sexual assault. And for a few weeks, she was hugged by the media. And she was sort of a symbol for all the anti-immigration forces here in Israel, until there came a moment when she confessed making up the entire story. She wasn't actually assaulted by this Eritrean refugee. And what really shocked me about this case was how fast she became from the national victim, from sort of media princess, how fast she became the national villain. So she was publicly denounced. She was called a monster and a psychopath. And I remember when I heard his story, I thought, maybe she's not a psychopath. Maybe she's a person like you and me. I mean, how miserable should someone be in order to make up such a lie in order to get attention? We usually say about those women, we either say that they don't exist and that there are no women who make up false accusations. And if they do exist, then they're monsters and they have nothing to do with us and with the human society. And I wanted to write about her not as a monster, but as a person, to try to understand her.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? It's fascinating and shocking, as you say, how quickly the media and the public can turn on somebody.
Yes, it's almost as if we're using them. I mean, people talked as if she was using us because she took our affection, and, you know, through lying, she became the sort of Cinderella, but the magic that turned her from no one to someone was the magic of a lie. But the truth was that we also, we being the public, we also used her. We consumed the story. We enjoyed this story. We enjoyed being shocked by it. We enjoyed discussing it. And in a way, I still see her as a victim, because she was a victim of the global need for a good story.
Yeah. Why do you think that's such a common thing, particularly these days, for the media and members of the public to need a good story, if you like?
Well, I think we're addicts, you know, just like people consume chocolate and you want it to be bittersweet, people consume stories. We want them to be bittersweet. We don't care how they're manufactured, just how we don't care about how chocolate is manufactured and who suffers on the way while making it. I'm not sure this is specifically about these days. I think it's very old human tendency, the need for a good story and not caring so much about the real facts as we care about our emotional response to the story. But perhaps it's more emphasized today, but I don't think post-truth is really such a new, it might be a new term, but I don't think it's a new phenomenon.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose I'm thinking about today more because we seem to hear about it more. And obviously with social media and people being able to criticize people in the public eye so easily, or even give them a massive amount of praise. It's all very easy to do these days, and a lot of people don't think that the people on the receiving end of their comments, being good or bad, are real people with feelings and families to go home to.
I very much agree with what you're saying, especially what you said about this need that we have for good and bad characters. So whenever we open the news, we want somebody, we ask who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And we don't usually try to think about it in a more complex way. I mean, in this case, first it was very clear that the girl is the innocent lamb and that the man is the big bad wolf. And then she became the wolf and he became the lamb. But I think usually in real life, we don't have wolves and lambs. We have people being good and bad at the same time. And this wish of us to have a very easy reality, a reality which is, you know, it has the good and bad, it serves our own need for the world to be very simple. It doesn't really the way the world works.
So when is this book set?
It's happening in Tel Aviv, in modern Tel Aviv. Though I did feel that it's universal, because I think the way we use words sometimes, not just to tell what's in front of us, but we also use words to conceal what really happened. This is not just an Israeli thing or a Tel Avivian thing. I think it's a universal thing.
Yeah. And can you tell us more about the characters in the book?
So the main character is Nofar, and she's this doll ice cream seller that turns into a sort of Cinderella thanks to a lie about a sexual assault that didn't actually happen. Now, she doesn't plan of lying. She has this customer who comes into the ice cream shop and really humiliates her. In a way, he really does assault her. Not sexually assault, but he clashes her into pieces with his words, the way he behaves towards her, which is the way many men allow themselves to behave to women from lower status. And so she runs away from the shop crying and sobbing. And people notice that something is wrong. And then they come and they automatically assume that he tried to sexually assault her. They ask her, did he hurt you? And she's sobbing and she nods with her head. And they say, did he attack you? And for her, it does feel like some sort of attack. So they automatically assume that it was a sexual assault. And the next thing she knows, she's in the center of attention. She gets affection. She for the first time in her life, she gets people to really look at her and to care about her. And it takes her a long time to realize that this is all thanks to your sexual assault that didn't really happen.
Wow, it's a very interesting one. So do you think, is your aim, in a way, if there is an aim, for people to read the book and empathize with her and her character and what she's going through?
I very much agree about trying to understand her rather than judge her. And I think when you hear about this story in the news, you automatically judge. You say, this girl is a monster. But as an author, I'm really interested in this point where somebody is considered a monster. And then your job as the author is to say, well, maybe he's not a monster. Maybe he's like you and me. Maybe the reader could do perhaps not the same thing, but something quite similar. I mean, we all lie, but at the same time, we all hate liars. I think it's a very interesting irony.
Yeah, it's fascinating how people are so quickly to judge people who have done something wrong, whether it's people who have lied or whether they have, you know, committed some form of assault. It is fascinating watching and hearing how people are very quick to kind of lay into someone on their bad behavior without any care or thought or understanding of why they might have behaved in such a way.
Yeah, I very much agree with what you're saying. And I think it's the author's job, but being a psychologist, I also feel it's the therapist's job, not to judge, but to try and understand. So that whenever you see someone doing something and you want to say, this is a monster, you turn this exclamation mark into a question mark and you ask, is this a monster? I mean, because if this girl would step in my clinic, then I can't just say, you're a monster, go away. I have to try to treat her. I have to try to understand what made her do what she did. And I feel also as an author, as a writer, I try at least at first, rather to judge my characters, to really try and understand them. So I found myself asking people if they remember their first lie, if they remember the first time they lied to someone, the first time they lied to their parents. And I got those amazing stories. And I think most people have a very, very clear memory of the first time they choose to lie.
What kind of answers were you getting?
I can tell you, but then I won't have any friends left. I got answered, but I promise not to use them in the novel. But yeah. I did hear a lot of stories that were about the feeling of terrible threat to the self. So that when a child lies to a parent, it often happens because the truth feels so unbearable. The consequences of the truth feel so unbearable that the child prefers to twist reality so that he won't have to face the fact that perhaps he let down one of his parents. Or it usually has a very strong relationship with shame.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. I've talked about this subject with friends before, and some people lied to their parents because they were fearful of the punishment from telling the truth. You know, if their father often particularly would shout really loudly, or they'd get grounded, mm-hmm. or possibly even smacked or hurt in some way, then the fear of that happening would make them lie. But for others, it's much more of an emotional thing, the idea of disappointing them and their parents, you know, being really upset that they would have done something like that. And it's a very different reasonings behind it.
Yeah, I agree. You have very different reasons, but I think it's mainly has to do really with fear of losing the love of somebody else. Sometimes you can have stories of people who actually enjoyed lying, and even then, which sounds a bit more of an antisocial thing to enjoy the lie rather than to escape to a lie. But even people who enjoy lying would usually say something like, I enjoy the fact that I have something of my own, something that nobody else knows but me. Like I had this secret garden that no one could enter, and the lie made me feel powerful. This sounds a bit more antisocial, but I also try to understand this mechanism.
And do you think a lot more people experience that than would like to let on?
It's a good question. I'm not sure most of people experience this feeling. I didn't hear it so often, but it's a good question if I didn't hear this answer so often because it's not true or because it is true, but no one would dare to say it.
Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting question, which, as you say, we might not ever know the answer to. Well, mm-hmm. If people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called Liar, and it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Ayelet Gundagoshen, who we've been talking to. Ayelet, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is experienced blogger Catherine Wallace. Her blog, I Know I Need to Stop Talking, has around 140,000 followers on Facebook and is growing rapidly. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel. It's called Absolutely Smashing It. And basically, the characters in the book end up realising that being a good parent is just about being good enough. Welcome to the book show, Catherine.
Thanks so much, Hannah.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks ever so much for joining us. And congratulations, your first novel. How does it feel?
It feels, I can't even describe it. I think it's been my dream since I was probably 5 years old. That's when I wrote my first ever book, was when I was 5 years old. It was very short. It was called The Camel Who Lost His Hump. I'm not sure how original that one was. but it's been my dream ever since then to write a novel. So to kind of have it come true, it's genuinely a pinch me kind of moment.
Oh, fantastic. And very different to blogging, I should imagine.
Yeah, it is, although, you know, to an extent what I found with writing, because I've blogged for a long time, my blog's been going, it'll be 10 years this year that I've been blogging, and actually with writing it's a little bit like a muscle memory, and I suppose the more you do it, you kind of build up that muscle memory, and it becomes easier, you start to know what works and what doesn't work. So It is different, but I definitely think for me, you know, kind of sort of the years of blogging made a huge difference in terms of how you then go about writing that novel.
Yeah. Have you changed the way you write, do you think, over the years?
Yeah, I definitely think that the nice thing with blogging is you get a very, you know, kind of you get a very quick reaction from readers. So you start to know what works. Certainly if you're writing comedy, people are not backwards in coming forwards in terms of what they find funny and what they don't. So you learn very quickly and you're able to respond to that. So I definitely think my style has refined. If I go back and I look at those very early blog posts now, I'm slightly mortified because I definitely think hopefully my writing's improved a bit since then. But it's all part of that learning curve.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about the blog then. I know I need to stop talking.
Yeah, so the blog I started writing back in 2009, and my son Jamie was nearly two at the time, and I just found myself in a place where I was, you know, the first out of all my friends to have children, and everybody I saw out there just seemed to know exactly what they were doing as parents, and I thought, my goodness, I've got no idea. I genuinely feel like I'm winging it every single day. And I really just started writing. I've always written diaries and things like that, and I really started blogging to just kind of get some of how I was feeling out. And then what started to happen, because at the time that I started blogging, it was around the time when really sort of the mum blogging phenomenon took off, although I hate being described as a mum blogger because I think we're all so much more than just, you know, kind of just a mum. But, you know, what I found was that actually there were other people out there saying, you know, it's not just you. I feel like this as well. I'm struggling. I'm finding this difficult. And over time, that's really built up, and that's built up. So something that I started doing really for me to try and make sense of how I was feeling and the things I was struggling with has built up to become something where, you know, every day I get messages from people who said, you know, I'm so grateful you wrote this post. That's exactly how I'm feeling. I'm struggling too. And it's, you know, that's always been my aim, to just hopefully make people feel a little bit less alone in what they're doing.
Yeah. I was going to say there's no manual on how to be a parent, but I suppose in an odd way there kind of is more and more. There's manuals for everything these days, how to do things and how not to do things, but even so, to read a book on how to be a parent is a sort of strange concept, isn't it? There's a lot of discovering that you do and a lot of advice. Everybody tells you the best way to do it, and then someone else will have another way to do it, so often you're kind of paddling underwater thinking, what do I do next?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think it's great. You know, I know there's some people who take to parenthood like ducks to water, and it's easy and their baby sleeps through the night. I mean, you know, Jamie probably didn't sleep through the night till he went to school and he was five, and I was thinking, what am I doing wrong? I think you can read the parenting manuals, but of course, you know, I like the saying which, you know, sort of somebody said, which the babies haven't read the book. Babies don't know what they're supposed to be doing, and if you have a baby that definitely doesn't follow the manuals, you start to think, what am I doing wrong? And I think there's this thing that because parenting is, you know, supposedly sort of it's a natural, you know, biological function, it's something that, you know, we naturally have to do to reproduce. I think somewhere along the lines, perhaps it's kind of been, you know, there's been this thing of, well, it should be easy because it's natural, but actually it's anything but easy. And I think we're slowly now starting to see the tide turning in terms of people just being a little bit more honest that, okay, for some people it might come naturally, but for a lot of us it's really tough, and there's no shame in finding it tough, and actually there are loads of great sources of support out there.
And I wonder how many people who do say that it's easy are lying a little bit.
Oh, 100%. And I also think there's that rose-tinted spectacles, isn't there, when you kind of, you know, you get perhaps grandparents looking back sort of, you know, to bringing up their own children many years ago, and they're like, oh, well, you know, in my day it was fine and it was easy. And all it takes is for one person to say that, and, you know, they're perhaps saying it in a really light-hearted manner, but actually for the person they're speaking to, that can have a really profound and long-lasting effect. And I do think we all need to be careful that we don't do that, because actually we never really know what somebody else is experiencing, what somebody else's story is.
Yeah, and it doesn't help. It never helps hearing things like that. It used to be easy. It's
no,
like, well, great,
absolutely.
Well done you.
Yeah, and you start to think, is it just me? Is it just me? Am I doing something wrong? And actually, you know, it comes back to, you're not. Just every baby's different, every child's different, every parent's different. But yeah, anybody saying, oh, you know, I don't know what the problem is. Parenting was a breeze, and, you know, it can be so damaging. We say these words in a lighthearted manner, but it can really be very, very damaging to individuals. We do need to be careful.
Definitely. So we're looking at the book then, Absolutely Smashing It, it's called. Tell us about some of the characters.
Yeah, so Absolutely Smashing It is centred around three central characters. So you've got Gemma. Gemma is a single mum. She's bringing up her two children, Ava and Sam, who are both at primary school. And she works full-time, so she's balancing trying to be a great parent with trying to be a great employee, with trying to occasionally find time for herself and kind of how all of those things come together. Then you've got Becky. Becky moves in next door to Gemma with her husband, lovely John, and her two children, Rosie and Ella. And Becky has kind of taken time away from the workplace to have her children, and perhaps, as I think a lot of us do, has started to lose a little bit of her sense of self in terms of actually, you know, what about me? Who actually am I anymore? I've become this mother, but where's the Becky that I once knew? And it's about, you know, kind of her own identity and all of that. And then you've also got Tom, and Tom is a teacher at the school of Ava and Sam and Rosie. And Tom's come to teaching from a very different background, which we find more about as the book progresses. And really, it's kind of a year in the life of those characters. It's, you know, Gemma hurtling towards the age of 40 and everything she wants to achieve before then. And, you know, ultimately, it's really, I hope, about the fact that actually, you know, we've all got our own things that we're struggling with. Nobody's smashing it every single day. And yet, at the same time, we are all absolutely smashing it in our own different ways.
Absolutely. It also looks like dating as well. Gemma getting back into dating.
Yeah, absolutely. Parent. She's kind of, you know, she's had a, sort of a couple of years where, you know, her ex, Nick, who walked out on her, so he's disappeared. She's had a couple of years where she's kind of been juggling work and, you know, sort of juggling the kids. And then Becky comes into her life and kind of says, right, we've got to get you a date. And, they have a little bit of a competition to try and get Gemma a date. And disasters follow as a result of that. But, yeah, she goes through that process to try and get herself a date off the back of that.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how so often comedy and comedic situations can come or can be made from things going wrong. Instead of
absolutely,
crying about absolutely. It and going, oh, God, this is a disaster, you can actually go, you know what, this is hilarious.
Absolutely, and I definitely think, you know, if I look back to, you know, kind of again some of my early years of parenting, all parents have that moment where their baby's pooed up against the opposite wall or you've gone out and they've you know, thrown up all over all their clothes. And, you know, my view has always been that the best way to get through some of those tough situations is to turn it around and to kind of laugh at it. I think, you know, it can feel horrendous at the time, but actually with the benefit of hindsight, you can, you know, if you can look back and laugh, then I think it perhaps softens the blow a little bit.
Definitely. And it's great fun to read these situations or watch them on television or film, you know, especially as so many parents will be able to relate to a lot of these things happening in a lot of these situations. And that kind of makes it funny, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that if I look at my blog posts, the ones that always resonate the most are the ones where, you know, somebody reads them and says, oh, my goodness, exactly the same happened to me, or I thought it was just me, or I can't believe your child embarrassed you in public like that as well. I think, you know, that there's a lot of similarities in terms of some of the things that we're all going through. And again, it comes back to this theme of just wanting people to feel a little bit less alone, because we are all dealing with this together.
Mm. So even though the book is fiction, have you kind of learnt a lot from it, and with the blogging as well? Have you kind of become a bit more relaxed?
Yeah, definitely. No, 100%. You know, it absolutely is fiction, but I think, you know, I've learned, and there's a lot of themes that have come through, certainly on the blog over the years, you know, the challenging of juggling perhaps being a working parent and, you know, juggling, you know, sort of parenting as well. And also, you know, sort of everything that Becky's going through, where you kind of come out the other side of having had children, and, you know, you can go whole weeks with somebody only ever referring to you as mummy, or, you know, you're such and such as mummy, and you think, actually, who am I anymore? You know, where's my identity gone? So there's definitely themes that come through, you know, sort of from the stuff on the blog, 100%.
Oh, and what do your family think about your writing?
Yeah, so my children, who may possibly bear the ever such a slight resemblance to Sam and Ava in the book, you know, kind of Jamie, my son, he's 11 now, and he's you know, completely nonplussed by anything. I'm sure his main concern is, am I going to embarrass him with it? And and Beth, my 8-year-old, she's a great entrepreneur. So all she's really interested in is how much money is she going to make from the book, which I have to assure her is absolutely nothing. But no, they take it in their stride. Occasionally, I think it gets mentioned by their friends, or, you know, your mum writes a blog, or your mum's written a book. But I think because it's something that I've always done, I think, you know, it kind of becomes something that's just part of the family. And my husband writes as well, so they're very used to, you know, kind of as all sitting around and writing. And they're even getting to the age now where they'll perhaps, you know, we're sitting writing and they'll bring out a notepad and they'll, you know, my daughter writes great stories, so that's quite nice as well. It's quite a nice family activity to do together.
Yeah, lovely. Well, do you think this is the first of many books for you, Catherine?
I would love it to be. I had such a ball writing it, and, you know, the response so far has been absolutely great. I think, you know, as I say, my overall aim has always been, if I can write something that ultimately makes people laugh and at the same time makes them feel like they're less alone, then I, you know, that's something that I'd love to do more of, 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the book is called Absolutely Smashing It, and it's the debut novel by Catherine Wallace, who we've been chatting to. If listeners want to get a copy of the book, they can from our website in the TRE bookshop section, and they can also find your blog by typing in "I know I need to stop talking." Catherine Wallace, thanks very much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much, Hannah. Really appreciate it.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.